This is Evolutionary Radio. We are coming at you live from the Evolutionary Radio headquarters. This is your host, Trevor Kuritz. And as always, my co-host, Steve Smee, is joining me.
Yes, good evening, guys. We're early June, so we're almost to summer officially. We have a special guest again on this podcast. Trevor, you want to introduce this gentleman?
I'll do the honors. We have IFBB Pro and owner of Scooby Prep, Jason Theobald, joining us. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
So, Jason, before we get into your backstory and everything, I got to ask, where did the name Scooby Prep come from? Out of all the things you could call your prep company, do you just like Scooby-Doo, or where did this come from?
Honestly, as a kid, it was my favorite cartoon, but that was not where it came from. So, you know, people are hoping that this has some great fitness background, and it does not. In college, I had a buddy that when you asked for a beer, he called a beer snack. And I kept bugging him, and, you know, we're all conversing and hanging out. And, you know, I asked for a beer, and he threw it at me. He goes, "Here's your beer snack." And then at some point, some drunk person started calling him Scooby Snacks, and then I'd ask for more. And then the Scooby Snack name stuck on me. And then they'd call me Snacks and Scooby Snacks. And when I got on the message boards, I just used the moniker because I needed a name. And, you know, a lot of people don't use their name. They come up with something catchy. So I went with Scooby Snacks. Well, it kind of stuck. And so when people would see me at shows, they would yell, "Hey, Scooby," not "Hey, Jason." So when I was setting up my prep company, I thought it was catchy. It was something people could remember. And so I went with it. And, you know, it's been good for marketing standpoint, I think. So it's kind of where it came from.
I mean, you could have picked a worse name. I mean, it's memorable and it's easy to remember, right? It's kind of like Apple. Like, Apple has nothing to do with computers, but exactly. It's easy to remember. People are like, okay, Apple. So, Jason, we had quite a few people request you to come on the show. I think a great way to introduce yourself is you could tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into weight training? Where did your passion for bodybuilding come from? How long have you been doing your prep business? Give us kind of like the rundown of your life.
Sure. So I grew up as a soccer player, and the game came easy to me quickly, but the size did not. And as everyone was hitting puberty and I wasn't, I was kind of getting left. And what looked like a trajectory to a Division I career ended up in a Division III, which was fine. But when I got there, I was one of a few freshmen that made the soccer team, but they looked at me and said, "If you want to play, you've got to get bigger and stronger." And my dad had been on me for years to hit the weight room, and I was just stubborn and maybe scared, maybe too lazy.
Having a little bit of technical difficulties with Jason. After Jason finishes talking about his background, our first topic is going to be insulin sensitivity. So that's a really good topic. I'm excited to pick Jason's brain about. Not too sure. I think Jason, are you back now?
Yeah. I don't know what happened there.
We had some technical difficulties. That's okay. So you were getting into your soccer.
So I remember exactly where I was, so you can splice it. So it was that January of my freshman year, I started weight training. And I had a pretty quick response, okay? So that kind of got me addicted to it because, you know, I went from the smaller kid to people commenting on my arms, and I got lean really quick. I'd never really had a six-pack, and now I was kind of like the ripped kid. And it's addicting when you kind of get those kind of results. I wasn't massive, but I was able to bench 225 fairly quickly, and just things that I never really thought that would happen. And with that came a lot more confidence in anything that I did, whether it was soccer or talking to women or going on a job interview. It didn't matter. And whether it made me a better person isn't true, but in my mind, I just had that feeling. And so it was very addicting for me. And so it kind of followed me. It followed me all through college. And when I got out, I joined a gym. I was in the real world now. And a couple bodybuilders were like, "You should compete." And I had never thought about it. I didn't know that I had the genetics. I didn't know that I had anything that would go to a stage. And so I did, and I was a bantam, and I did fairly well. And from there, I was kind of hooked. And I never – so I should tell you, I started as a bantam. I ended up getting up into the top end of the middleweight, and then I went into classic physique. And that's where I got my pro card, in the classic physique division. As far as how my contest prep business started, I never really – set out to be a contest prep coach. You know, nowadays people set out to do it. I didn't. I had just studied a lot on how to make myself a better bodybuilder because I didn't have the greatest genetics. And as people were seeing me get better, they wanted me to prep them. And I was doing it for free for a long time. And what I did was, there was a supplement company called Beverly International, and they were local to me. And I could pick up their supplements, and they'd give me a good discount. And then I just told anyone I helped, I said, buy your supplements from me. There's going to be no charge on the prep fee. And I would meet with them every Sunday. Well, this started growing because I was taking guys who were perennial second place winners, getting overalls. So I was getting results fast. And the word of mouth grew. And it got to the point where I'd have 10 or 15 people in the house on Sundays. And my wife said, look, either make this a business or stop. Like, it's you're consumed all day with this bodybuilding stuff. And I'm like, you really think people will pay? And she's like, I know people will pay. And so we started out light. It was like $200 a fee, and it just kept growing. And I'm like, I can't keep up with this rate. So it was more organic than just saying, hey, I want to be a prep coach. It was kind of, the demand was there. And so the business kind of flowed from that.
I love how it was your wife who was like, hey, Jason, make this into a business. Let's start making some money.
Yes, she was.
Well, you're just having fun. You're just like, hey, I just like helping people. I'm just having fun here.
Correct. I never saw it as more than maybe like even just vacation money. I never thought it'd be a career. And if a lot of your listeners don't know you, I went to law school. I practiced law for 15 years as in-house counsel. It was not a passion of mine. It was a good living, and it allowed me to build my business. And I probably stayed in doing it way longer than I needed. Because my business was flourishing, and I just quit law just last December. But I could have quit probably 5 or 6 years ago. I'm just one of those people that want to make sure that my concept is definitely solid. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that the business was successful. So
Jason, before we get into our first topic, can you tell us some, approximately how old are you, and where are you living now, and where did you live before?
Sure. So I'm 40. I got my pro card at 38. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm in Independence, Kentucky right now. And actually that's only 15 minutes from downtown Cincinnati. So I didn't venture too far from where I grew up. And I think I answered your questions.
So our first topic for Jason is muscle insulin sensitivity. Jason, start rambling on, and then me and Steve will feed you feeder questions.
Sure. So, I mean, I normally start off with just telling people, I just like to explain what insulin sensitivity is first for people in a dumbed down way. Because I mean, that's how I think. I like to know the nuts and bolts of things. I'm not going to kill you with tons of scientific data here, but basically in a nutshell, insulin sensitivity, first off, you want to have it. You want to live in that state as a physique competitor and a bodybuilder. So it means that your body is really receptive to its own insulin. And what that means is you're going to have improved nutrition partitioning. You're going to use your nutrients better to build muscle, stay leaner, and put them where they need to be. You're not going to, I'd like to kind of give an example of like a traffic jam. If your body is less insulin sensitive, it's kind of like a traffic jam inside your bloodstream and your body. The carbs, the nutrients aren't getting where they need to be. And that's because your body is not receptive to its own insulin. The cells aren't opening up. Insulin basically acts as like a key to the cells that need to be opened up. And when you're very insulin sensitive, the key goes in easy, it turns, and the cell opens up. And your nutrients go where you want, and you're going to stay leaner. You're going to get better pumps. You're going to build muscle faster. When your insulin sensitivity takes a nosedive, the traffic jam starts because the door can't get open and everything kind of backs up. And then what happens is you're going to release more insulin to try to take care of that. And over time, your cells just kind of run out and wear out. So the higher your insulin sensitivity is, the better you are off in staying leaner and building muscle. That's from that standpoint, but just from a health standpoint, you're going to be healthier by keeping your blood sugars down, your fasted blood sugars, how you respond to a meal, returning, postprandial 2.5 hours after you eat, you should be almost back to baseline. All these different things are going to slow down aging and just make you a better physique athlete. And we can control that to some extent. That's why it's an exciting topic for me. I mean, you know, it's harder to boost your testosterone naturally. I mean, there's some, you know, supplements out there and you can eat more fats. But, you know, I've found that insulin sensitivity is one of those things that I can really manipulate with either, you know, whether my client is natural or not, I can really manipulate it to make the cuts more successful or the dieting or the building phase more successful.
So I know I'm going to let Steve go because I know Steve is a big fan of intermittent fasting.
Before we kind of dig into this, Jason, because I, you know, in a typical franchise gym, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that most of the guys in the gym are going to have more insulin resistant type of, body, because I notice a lot of them are holding, you know, somewhere between, let's say, 17 to 22% or more body fat.
Correct.
They're big. They eat a lot. They're strong, stronger than, you know, the normal guy in the street, but they're not strong for their size.
Yep.
What percentage of guys do you think that are in the gym are actually having this insulin resistant issue that they need to switch around? Let's start with that first. Can you give us some
stats? I'm going to go out on a limb and say the guys that you just explained who are kind of farm boy big, I would say 85 to 90% of them are going to have some insulin resistance because they're pounding the hell out of carbs, not the greatest food, not the greatest diet. And that's why their body fat is that high, even though they train. It's because they have poor insulin sensitivity. So I'm going to say it's very high and that it's not understood by them how they can manipulate it to be more in their favor. I would say it's definitely high. And that's just talking about the gym population. You talk about America. It's I think you guys are.
Yeah, it's probably really high in America, considering half of America is at least 30% body fat from the stat I just read. Now, what are the symptoms of being insulin sensitive? I will for sure say that probably in my late 20s, early 30s, I was definitely insulin sensitive. I was that 15, 16, 17% body fat, strong guy who can bench, you know, three plates for reps. And then I totally changed the way I approach eating. And now I'm more insulin sensitive. I don't get those hypo symptoms like where I have to eat every 2 hours. Is that a symptom of being insulin resistant?
Going hypo can definitely be a symptom. But you know, a lot of other symptoms that you're going to see are high body fat, sluggish throughout the day. You're not going to get good pumps. They're going to wear out. So you're not going to get as good of pumps as you would the leaner you are. And so you can kind of see guys, especially like after they've done a show or a cut and they've got these awesome pumps and they start to fade. Well, that's because your insulin sensitivity faded. Guys always wonder, why is that? Well, it's because you kept pounding food and you basically kind of shortened the window of how long your body would stay sensitive. So I usually see sluggishness, body fat accumulation. You can be going hypo, but not everyone does. The reason you'd be going hypo is because as the sugars stay elevated, your body's pumping out more insulin, and finally it gets enough and it overshoots and then it tanks you down. Less pumps are for sure. If it stays that way really long, you'll kind of see like what people call Palumboism, and like the limbs will stop responding and the legs. And the gut starts to expand because when your blood sugars are super high, you have neurodegeneration of the muscles in the stomach. That's why a lot of these guys pounding GH are getting that. It's not because of GH. I mean, it might make your intestines a little bigger, but honestly, if guys knew how to control their blood sugars on GH, they would not be getting those huge guts.
Using HGH will increase your chance of being insulin resistant.
It's 100% fact. It's 100% fact. GH raises fasted blood sugar. It raises your blood sugars all day. So that's why you have to either use insulin with it, or you have to cycle your GH, and you got to track your blood glucose using a
Cycling GH. Can you be more specific? Would that be 3 months on,
2 days off? That might be enough for you. Or you might have to just do, like, you know, you might get 6 to 8 weeks out of it, and then you're over 100 on your fasted blood glucose. And I would say pull back then, or get off of it and reset. But that's, you know, it's the neurodegeneration of the muscles in the stomach caused by high blood sugars chronically that actually cause those bellies where they can't control their insides. The muscles weaken.
That's a really good tip. Yeah. What about you can finish with that, but also steroids. Is the trenbolone tend to increase insulin resistance as well? Because I noticed that when I run trenbolone and abuse it, I get more insulin sense. So go ahead.
Yeah. You could get a little bit on the tren. You could get a little resistant, but also though, tren helps you burn through carbs so fast that, you know, it's kind of like a give and take, but that's why some guys get horrible night sweats on tren. It's because of the resistance that's causing, and the blood sugars are going kind of wonky in the middle of the night. So there's definitely some of that there, but honestly, the biggest culprit when you're in enhanced bodybuilding for insulin resistance is GH use. So you can counter it with insulin use as well. I mean, you know, if you want to prolong it, but that's where guys fail, and that's why the bellies get out of control when you're on the enhanced side.
So Jason, for our listeners who want to increase muscle insulin sensitivity, what would you do? Are there certain diet approaches or certain lifestyle approaches?
There's like diet and supplement approaches. Supplements? Yeah, so let's talk about that. So first off, you know, I always have my clients get a glucometer, okay? And I want a fasted reading, and then I'll also have them track where they're at postprandial about 2.5 hours after a meal. And so I'm going to track that and see where they're at. I like someone between about 72 to 85 is a really good range. Anyone who's getting near 100, I'm going to reset them. Now I'm talking about fasted blood glucose on that number, okay? In our country, in America, the American Diabetes Association has said 100 or higher is pre-diabetic. So we know at that point you're less insulin sensitive. So that's kind of my cutoff for how I watch my clients. So they get near 100, we're going to reset, and I'll explain how to do that. If we're staying under 100, okay, but I really prefer you in like the 72 to 85 range on your fasted blood glucose. So how do you reset if you get to that range? Like someone's out there listening now and they're like, okay, well, I'm gonna go get a glucometer and see where I'm at. And let's say they come back at 101 on their fasted. There's a couple ways to reset. Some people can reset just by taking their carbs and halving them and then putting those calories into fat. So they're not really losing any calories. They're just changing their macro distribution. This works pretty well for me. So let's say, as an example, my current diet is 290 protein, 300 carbs, and 50 fat. I would take the 300 carbs down to 150, multiply that by 4, that's what, 600 calories, divide that by 9. I'm not that good at math, but let's say that's about 55 fats. It's probably more, but I'm going to shove all that now into my fat distribution. So I haven't created a deficit. I've just moved my macros around to have less carbohydrate load on my body. Some people will respond to that after a few to 4 or 5 days, you'll start seeing the numbers come down. However, there are some people that must be in a deficit. So that's not even going to work. They've got to create a deficit and lose the carbs and not give themselves back fats to start getting it to come down. Did you have a question there?
What I was going to ask is, so if you want to do the approach where you take, you know, let's say 600 calories of carbs and replace them with fats, is there a certain type of fat? Would you use like maybe coconut or?
Yes. That's a good question. So the fats you would want to use are anti-inflammatory because insulin insensitivity causes more inflammation in the body. So, you know, you're going to want to pick things like extra virgin olive oil, mac nut oil, almonds are good. I would stay away from a high percentage of omega-6, like peanut butter. I wouldn't start down in, you know, a jar of that a day. I would get more omega-3 heavy fats in there. And I think that's the best way to approach it, because you're getting that anti-inflammatory effect. You don't want to use a lot of, saturated fats and things like that. So that's one way. But then, like I said, some people have to go into a deficit. So I'm just going to cut their carbs in half and then work them that way. So that's the nutrition side. Supplementation side, you've got to add in a glucose disposal agent, and there's a bunch of different ones. I have my own supplement line. I have GDA Max under New Ethics. That's what I use for my clients. And that's a blend of different herbs and minerals and vitamins. And it's not proprietary. You can look at it. I don't believe in bringing out proprietary blends, but we've got berberine in it. We've got chromium polynicotinate in it. We've got RALA in it. It's a wide variety of proven insulin mimetics to help bring that down. So not only have we made a diet change, now we're helping with the glucose disposal agent. Also, stress will impact insulin sensitivity. So a lot of times I'm going to put someone on my Cordis product. Not always, because sometimes people just don't have a stressful life and I don't feel the need. But if I think that there's a stressful component and cortisol is running high, I'm going to bring cortisol down too. And sometimes you might even have to beef that up with ashwagandha. And I'll run that up to a 1500 mg morning and night if I got to really bring someone down who's just a type A stressful person. So insulin sensitivity mainly in this industry is driven by diet, but it can also be driven by stressful situations. It can also be driven by a bad gut, because that's going to create inflammation, which is going to spike cortisol. So you're always, as a coach, you've got to always have an understanding of, you know, the biofeedback your clients are getting, and you got to ask the right questions. You got to know if their gut's going well, because if you're pushing calories and they're getting indigestion, they're getting bloat, they're getting gas, you want to nip that in the bud. But if you didn't, then you're going to have to nip it in the bud at some point, because that could cause stress to the body, which then will make you insulin insensitive. So there's a lot of moving pieces to the supplement side. And, you know, I like to only use what I need, but 99% of the time I'm going to add a GDA while I'm doing the nutrition part of it.
So we're going to get into the digestion in a second as the next topic. Before we do, I have one more question for you. Meal timing and meal frequency, does that, in 100%. Your opinion, affect the insulin sensitivity?
Yes. When I bring their carbs down to the, let's go back to the example we use, 150, I'm going to carb time that person. And so I might only give them, you know, 30 carbs in the morning, and the rest of it's going to be pre, intra, and post, only when they need it. So I'm not bombarding their body all day with a little bit of carbs. I'm not spreading those over five meals with 30 per meal. I'm going to use more of the healthy fats in the other meals and just give them carbs. And I might not even give them carbs in the morning. Sometimes it's all pre, intra, post. It just depends on how difficult a case it is to reset them. But I think carb timing is the most important. And there's some other things that you can do with diet. Like, so there's research out there that suggests, and it's, you know, it's not hard to understand this, but they went ahead and done the research, but this makes total sense. Having your carbs and doing like a carb fast for 12 hours. So like, let's say your last carbs, this is how I do it. My last carbs are normally at 7 p.m. I fast in the morning. I get up, take my health stuff, and I don't eat again until about 10 a.m. So from 7 to 10 a.m., I'm having no carbs. I am getting some protein and fats in, but I'm having no carbs. So I'm kind of doing a carb fast, and that improves insulin sensitivity. So I may use that with people as well. So not only my carb timing, I'm going to throw in a little bit of a carb fast with them as well. And that helps to you know, also attack the issue.
So this whole calories in thing, out thing throughout the whole day, like people who say it doesn't matter, you know, calories in, calories out is all that counts. And you shouldn't care about meal timing. You shouldn't care about when you eat. You shouldn't care about going gaps without food. You're saying that's incorrect, because we see that cookie cutter thing that most coaches, like I'll say Jerry Ward, which I don't dislike the guy, but I'm just using him as an example. If you look up his cookie cutter diet that he gives to people. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, 6 to 8 meals a day, eat every 2 hours, blah, blah, blah. So you're saying that that is basically not going to fly, basically, if you're trying to get your insulin resistance changed?
It could for some people, but for people who are a little more difficult, you're going to have to carb time and give your body periods where you're not making the beta cells work and you're not making the body produce insulin. Just give everything a chance to kind of relax. There's research that shows that fasting does help improve insulin sensitivity. So I'm not a big fan of putting someone on 48 hours and no food, but if I can work carb fast in, I'm going to do it. Now, as far as calories in and calories out doesn't matter, I don't care what studies there are out there. I'm not going to, you know, if you tell someone to eat 1,000 calories from protein and then you tell them to eat 1,000 calories from carbs, the person doing protein is going to lose better. You waste more protein than you do carbs. Carbs is a very efficient energy source. And then you can even get into what kind of carbs are you talking about? Like, different carbs are going to elicit a bigger insulin response. So if it's 30 carbs of cookies versus 30 carbs of oatmeal, it's a different insulin response. So I don't even get into arguments with people on that shit. I've been doing this long enough. If you get that really special person who's super insulin sensitive, yeah, they can diet on ice cream and yeah, they can do this and hit their macros. But I'm working with, there's so many goddamn divisions now and freaking bodybuilding that you're not working with all these genetic freaks. You're working with people who have shitty insulin sensitivity, big fat asses, guts, FUPAs, all this shit gets thrown at you and you've got to be good at it all. And so, no, I'm getting on a rant there, but no, I don't believe in calories in, calories out. You know, this calorie is the same as that calorie, all that stuff.
What about fat? You touched on carbs and protein. What about like nuts? Like, if I eat 500 calories of nuts, am I going to get fat versus eating 500 calories of donuts? You see what I'm saying? I have this debate too. Trevor and I debate this a lot. And I insist, yeah. I tell Trevor I eat like fucking 700-800 calories of nuts a day, yeah, and I don't get fat. But I tell him, like, if I was to eat donuts and cookies and pizza somewhere, I would get fat because I've been there.
Well, there's way less of an insulin response from the nuts. I eat a lot of fat too when I'm not getting ready for a show. I eat probably about 110 grams of fat a day. And no, I'm gonna 100% say if you ate, you know, 1,000 calories in donuts versus 1,000 calories of almond butter, you're gonna look way worse on the 1,000 calories of donuts. Again, I don't buy the calorie.
I think you feel a lot better too. I think we all can agree on that.
Much better than on the
1,000 calories of Chick-fil-A. You probably
we're
feel
not
like
even
shit,
debating, you know, the health aspect of it. Just debating, like, you know, some people believe, like I said, you know, you eat 1,000 calories of whatever macro it is, it's all going to be the same in the end. And I'm just saying that's not what I've seen in dealing with thousands of people who just don't have great insulin sensitivity or really the genetics. And you're trying to get them in the best situation to lose body fat.
I agree with everything you said, Jason. I think people forget that calories are a measurement of energy. Right? It's calculated through a bomb calorimeter. Yep. You could take firewood, you could take a jacket, you could take a pair of jeans, and you could put it in a bomb calorimeter, and it would show a calorie content. Mm-hmm. So calories is just a unit of energy, right? What matters much more is what those calories are compromised of. And then, like you said, carbohydrate, it depends whether those are monosaccharides, disaccharides, polysaccharides, that all of that. How your body digests it, how it's assimilated, things like that. So our next topic is digestion. Jason, I wanted you to talk to us a little bit about what are some of the most common digestive issues you see in bodybuilders, and what are some of the strategies to improve those?
Okay, so the biggest one I see in bodybuilders is bloat and gas. Like, that's the most common. And a lot of bodybuilders, and I was guilty of this in my like late 20s, think that that's just necessary to be a bodybuilder. You know, oh, well, I got to push this food and I'm just going to be bloated. I'm going to be gassy and everyone around me just has to live with it and I have to live with it. And as you get a little wiser and a little smarter and a little more educated, you realize that the amount of stress and inflammation that's putting on your body, you're not even going to grow as efficiently as you could if you just fixed all that. And so that's the number one I see. And that's one of the easier ones to fix, really. So a lot of times it comes from the food choices, but also overeating protein. And then, you know, helping the gut biome, but also, you know, maybe sometimes a lot of people, because of the stress of training and just their daily life, that actually causes you to produce less stomach acid. So sometimes you got to beef up the stomach acid with betaine hydrochloric. But first and foremost, I'm going to examine the diet. And a lot of times it's too much protein. I'm a big believer, and you know, you could have a debate with another prep coach who gets just as good a results, but I track every macro. So I track the protein from your oats. I track the protein from any source. So you have a lot of guys who are eating 300 grams of protein, but then they're also getting about 90 from other trace sources, and they're 180 pounds. And I'm like, you just don't need all that. And you could free up the carbs and fats and get more energy sources and feel better and still burn a good amount of fat. I'm not going to give you a low protein, but I can just kind of move everything around and kind of get your gut efficient. And when your gut's more efficient, you know, you're going to burn fat better. So it's all about efficiencies. So a lot of times I can lower their protein, give them just a little bit more, maybe energy source and try to get their gut a little healthier. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to lower protein. I'm going to a lot of times give them a probiotic. I like a full spectrum one. The one I use is from Metagenics. It's called Ultraflora, and it's just a full spectrum probiotic. If I feel like they need it because of the amount of protein and carbs that they just need to maintain their size as they're dieting, I would maybe use betaine hydrochloric. And again, I use Metagest there, but there's a lot of different companies who make a good one. And what I do is it's called like the Metagest challenge. I start people out with two. I then say, if you don't get any burning, go to three. If you don't get any burning, go to four. If you do get any burning, drop back a pill, but I get them up to four per meal. And, that usually supplements the protein and the carbs. And then you can add a pancreatin, pancreatin enzyme if you need that too. So there's a lot of different directions you can come from on how to just solve that bloat and gas issue. If someone said, give me the top two that you're going to use. So nutritionally, I'm going to bring protein down most likely. I'm going to add betaine hydrochloric, and I'm probably going to go ahead and give them a probiotic, and I'm going to start there. And a lot of times that solves most of the ills that a lot of bodybuilders kind of put their digestive stress, stress on their body. So
I know Trevor wants to get in, but I have to ask this. It's a question that everyone's always embarrassed to talk about. How often should we be having bowel movements? Because yeah, we do eat a lot as bodybuilders and weightlifters. How often should it be after every meal? Should it be, you know, how often would you say is healthy?
So that is going to have to do with input, you know, and output. So, you know, you have to go at least once a day. Like if you're not doing that, that's bad. You know, when I'm looking at health, you know, people have to eat right. They have to sleep right. They have to poop right. I mean, there's all these different things that have to be going on in the system to be efficient. So it must be at least once a day. If you're not, we've got to look at what we can do to improve that. But if you're eating a lot of food, it 2 to 3 times a day could be completely normal. If you get up into 4 and 5 and it's really the lack of being gross, squishy, runny, there's something else at play there. And you probably need to look at that, because if the transit time is too fast, you're not getting probably all the nutrients you need as well out of the feedings. So I would say 2 to 3 well-shaped, formed bowel movements if you're really pushing calories. If you're at a moderate intake, at least go once a day, and that'll be good for health. Anything less, you need to discuss it with your coach, or you need to look at what's going on. And so just because while we're on it, one of the biggest things I do, other than getting fiber right, you know, 35 to 50 grams, depending on the size of the person, I want to at least make sure they're getting that, is I'm going to add magnesium citrate. It has to be citrate. And that's good for getting the motility going, getting the muscles down there firing. And I usually start at 400 migs in one sitting, and that usually works for a lot of people. But I've gone up as high as, I think, 1,800 migs for a couple people. But me, myself, if I hit 800 migs, I'm gonna have loose stools and be going a lot. So I start at 400 and then add 200 as people go. But magnesium citrate, along with getting the proper amount of fiber, is going to solve a lot of people's issues with constipation. Now, you can go into my next, like, line of defense, if we want to call it, would be then adding a stool softener. I don't like to do laxatives because the body can become reliant on them. So a stool softener would be my next line of defense after the first two we talked about. If there's still issues, then I might go to, like, some of the teas that have senna in it. Those can cause a little reliance. You can become a little bit reliant on those. So I that's why that's fourth in line. And then last, I will go to a child's laxative before I go to an adult's. I really don't like to get into relying on laxatives. I try to, at that point, fix what's going on. But, like, sometimes you just got to get someone relief at first. And then we go ahead and try to figure out what else can we do here to kind of figure this out. Maybe they're lacking in fats. I've seen with some women, if you don't have enough fat in their diet, it really slows down. So, you know, we might have to be of something, we have to change something dietarily as well. So,
Jason, there's a famous German saying that's feel fresh, feel scheiß, which means eat a lot, shit a lot.
Yes. Yep.
And it's true. And what you said with laxatives, it was actually, it makes me think about a vacation I had to Japan. It was a family vacation. We were pretty young. I think I was like 13 or 14. My sister was like 11 or 12. Mm. And they had these little bottles that almost looked like, it had like a label similar to like Coca-Cola. And it was carbonated. So we kind of just assumed, you know, this was Japanese pop.
Sure, so yeah.
At like, you know, a vending machine or a gas station or something like that. My sister, she would buy them. She really, really liked them. I would just drink water. I'm pretty simple. But anyway, so we're going on, and everything's Japanese. Like, there's very, very little English.
Right, right.
We meet this tour guide who speaks English, and he sees my sister drinking one of these, and he's asking, like, are you feeling okay? And she's like, yeah, I feel fine. He's like, well, right. What are you talking about? He's like, well, I noticed you're drinking a laxative. So the entire trip, my sister was drinking these laxatives, like drinking like four or five of them a day.
Oh shit.
She's like, no wonder I was going to the bathroom like six times a day.
She's like, man, I'm so regular in Japan. I love this place. That's hilarious.
So one question I want to ask you, Jason, is food sensitivity testing. Is this something you ever do with your clients? And then are there ever certain foods that you don't recommend including in client programs? Like things like dairy, gluten. Yep. So why do you just generally not include those?
So there has been times where I have had people go to the doctor and get food sensitivity tests because I couldn't eliminate or figure out, and neither could they, what was going on. So as a last line of defense, generally I do, but I try to solve the problem through elimination if I can, without making them go spend more money and wait on a test, et cetera, et cetera. But there are times when there are just things going on after you know, you get down to the fifth line of defense and they're complete, you know, nothing's responding. They're you know, continually constipated or they're continually diarrhea or one of those, then yes, I would highly recommend going and getting a food sensitivity. As far as the foods I use during prep, if someone comes to me and they're in like, I give out an MSQ, it's a metabolic stress questionnaire. And if there's no red flags that I need to fix and get them healthy before prep, generally, I have a pretty wide open range of foods. If no one's saying they have a dairy problem, I'll allow them to use dairy. If someone, you know, fruits, things of that nature, I'm allow it. The only thing that I'm a big proponent of is no real processed foods. Like, I'm not a big fan of like subbing in ice cream. I know like some of these guys do with like the, you know, if it fits your macros, things like that. But I try not to eliminate too many things. Now, if we're noticing that they're having problems, dairy is one of the first to go, gluten, steak. I'll even pull chicken and turkey if they're having digestion problems. Just use fish and things that are known to be easier on the digestive tract. I use FODMAP eating a lot, which was actually invented for IBS. but it works great. If I have someone who's just got like, you know, maybe I get someone with a candida infestation, I'm going to go ahead and like put them on FODMAP and get like the foods that they're eating that are the most easier, you know, the easiest to digest and start with that. So the answer is if they're completely healthy, I don't rule out any type of food off the bat. But as I get in and I see issues, dairy gets pulled quickly, gluten gets pulled, hard to digest meats, some hard to digest veggies, you know, we might not allow. So I kind of do that based on the client.
And you touched on IBS a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about IBS and Crohn's disease? I got countless guys messaging me who have Crohn's. These guys were in the military and it literally ruined their life. There's some guys, you know, listening right now. It's affects so many people. Like, what are some tips to help these guys?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so affecting their bodybuilding and life, you know?
Yep. So first and foremost, you're going to want to get on the FODMAP diet. So you can Google FODMAP and IBS. Okay. And you're going to find basically a list of all the foods that you can have and not have if you have IBS. And that is going to help tremendously, tremendously to just start bring down the inflammation. Okay. So that's my first step. You know, I always start with the nutrition. And basically with IBS and Crohn's and things like that, you're trying to make it dormant, but never are they going to be like healed in my experience. Anytime they eat off something that's, you know, that they've kind of found as a trigger or that is not on that list, or depending on how you're looking at it, it could be it's not on the list of approved foods. They might have a flare-up. So I teach them how to deal with flare-ups too. But so we start with FODMAP, right? So that's no dairy, no alcohol, no gluten. It eliminates chicken and beef and turkey because they're hard to digest. We were talking about that before. You can use egg whites. You can use fish of any kind. You can use whey iso, but no concentrate. We want things that are really easy to digest. Then what I'm going to do is I have a probiotic that Metagenics carries in my store, and it's made for IBS. So I'm going to put them on that specific probiotic for the IBS to help immediately. It's got a high strain of Boulardii in it, and that kills yeast as well as some SIBO issues, okay? I'm going to put them on a product also called Intisol. It's got a lot of just great things for anti-inflammatory. So one of them is like curcumin, which is a really concentrated form of curcumin. And I think probably a lot of listeners have heard curcumin and know how anti-inflammatory it is and how helpful it is to the body for preventing not only LVH for guys who are on PEDs, but anti-cancerous, but it's also great to calm the inflammation in these people's guts. I'm going to use fish oil, probably 4 per day. Another, again, as you see, anti-inflammatory. If I suspect they have candida, I put them on a product called Candibactin. It kills the bacteria, as I'm now putting in the good bacteria that they need. So that's generally kind of how I work the program. I'm looking to get them their inflammation down super quickly, and then foods that digest very easily, and you know, hit them with these the good flora and support for anti-inflammatory. And I mean, I've had a lot of people who have came to me who were running to the bathroom, you know, basically after every meal. And I have them with that protocol, having normal stools and able to bodybuild again. So it's about managing the condition and then being able to teach them what foods kind of set them off. And so after they've been eating on FODMAP for a while, you know, I'll have people be like, well, can I get chicken back in? I'm like, yep, let's try chicken and see how it does. And if there's no response, then they know they can put that back in. And we'll work back in the foods that they really miss and see what happens. And if we do it one at a time, if they have a flare, like I had a girl respond to beef, we simply know that just beef is never going to be a part of her life. And she's fine with that. You know, she's like, I'll miss steak a little bit, but I'd rather not be shitting every time I eat either. So, you know, there are going to be things that they're going to miss, but it's better in the long run that they don't have an inflamed gut and they're not having diarrhea five times a day. So that's kind of how I attack the IBS situation.
So Jason, we got about 10 minutes left. We got a listener question for you. He wanted to know your thoughts on pre-contest cutting agents. So things like clenbuterol, T3. What are your thoughts on the drugs themselves? And then when would you implement them into someone's cutting?
Right. That's kind of the thing. When is more of the when, but I will go through them and what I like and what I don't. So clenbuterol, the science behind it, I believe it says it'll increase your metabolism by about 10%, which isn't a whole hell of a lot, but I'm not going to lie and say it doesn't help burn body fat. It also will help you burn through carbs more. It's going to leave you a little flatter, but I do find that it is helpful. The thing with clenbuterol is you have to appreciate that it can really affect your adrenal health if you stay on it too long. And I see people who start at 16 weeks out and take it daily, and I don't like that. So I would, if you're a more stubborn fat loss person, use clenbuterol, but I'm going to tell you how I use it. Personally, I think for my, this is the truth, for my run for my IFBB Pro card, I used it for 2 weeks tops. If you don't need it, I don't use it, but a lot of times for a lot of women who are in the NPC, it comes in handy. But men, it's kind of touch and go depending on whether they need it. But here's how I would do it. I wouldn't bring it in until you're about 10 to 12 weeks out and you've already spent 6 to 8 weeks losing easy fat. Then what I would do is I would rotate it with yohimbine hydrochloric. And yohimbine turns off the alpha-2 receptors in your stubborn fat stores. That's more in the more brown fat. And clen turns off the beta receptors. And both of these receptors being turned off allows fat to be liberated and burned. Okay. So these are basically turning off those receptors, allowing fat to be used as energy sources. So I would do 2 days of clen, start really low, like 20 micrograms, do 10 micrograms morning pre-cardio and 10 mics pre-lifting. Okay. Do 2 days of that and then do 2 days of yohimbine. So you come off the clen and now hit the yohimbine. I would do yohimbine. Here's the thing. It can cause anxiety in some people. It does myself. I rarely use it. If I use yohimbine, it's more in a topical fat burner where I'll put it on like my love handle back area or on the glutes and hamstrings. It doesn't get systematic as much as if you take it orally. But if you can handle it, it's a great fat burner, and I would do – you can do 10 milligrams per 1 pound of body weight, but I wouldn't start there. I start my people 5 milligrams morning, 5 milligrams pre-lift, okay? Just go back and forth, 2 and 2 on those. So you're never on clen for more than 2 days, and you're back and forth hitting the different receptors. If someone is still pretty stubborn, did you have a question before I move forward, Trevor?
I had 2 questions. So you said 5 milligrams per 1 pound of body weight?
10 milligrams per 1 pound of body weight.
So that's a pretty hefty dosage. So if someone weighs 200 pounds, that'd be 2 grams.
No, it shouldn't be that high at all. Did I state that backwards? I stated it backwards. It's 1 milligram for every 10 pounds. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That makes more sense.
Yeah. So 170 pound person would be up to 17 milligrams. Yeah. I stated it backwards. Sorry about that.
I was making sure.
No, it's good thing you cleared it up. I stated it backwards.
And the second question I had is, so if you read any of Lyle McDonald's work, he's a big, big fan of yohimbine, but he says it has to be taken fasted. What are your thoughts on that?
So he's not wrong, okay? So that when I finally get the dosages up higher, I like to take as much as I can with the client in the morning, okay? But I like to just start 5 and 5 to assess tolerance. But here's the way I look at it. Pre-workout, most of my people haven't eaten for about 2 hours. Their insulin has returned to a fairly baseline level. The reason he likes that is because the insulin can't – if insulin is high, yohimbine doesn't work well, okay? That's the rule. So I generally, you know, people should be back down to a decent level. And I like to get it in when you've got, you know, you're pushing your training and your cardio. So he might argue with me on that and say it's completely worthless, but I've seen other ways and I've seen it differently. And the problem is I can't take 10 milligrams of that stuff all at once. And some other people may not be able to either. So I like to split it up and just kind of play with tolerance. But he is correct. The lower the insulin at the time, the better it's going to work.
And all this stuff, is it really necessary to feel miserable pre-contest, like leading up to a contest? Or can you actually get away with feeling, you know, okay or good? Is it always going to be mandatory?
Like, you're going to feel like total dog ass to get shredded at least the last 4 to 5 weeks. That's when I drag ass and I feel like I'm walking in sand with 100 pounds on my back. Up to that point, I don't feel too bad. I think it's a mental. I think you can teach your mind to be like, you know what? I'm going to go socialize. I'm going to be good to my spouse. I'm going to be good to my kids. You know, but the last 4 to 5 weeks, no matter what I do, because I'm already pretty damn low in body fat, I just drag. And I think that's just the way it has to be. If you're still feeling excellent at 3 weeks out, I would be like, let me see your pictures. Let me see how your lower back looks. Let me see how your hamstrings look. Because I'm going to question it. So,
Jason, I love the fact you said that, because the problem is now with Instagram and filters and stuff, you can take a photo and be in, you know, decent shape and absolutely shredded. But if you're doing a legitimate bodybuilding show and you don't feel miserable, you know, the last couple weeks, you're not going to be in shape.
No. Here I can give you a perfect example. So this year, or when I did Masters Nationals and won my card, I was able to reverse diet at about the 3 week out mark and into the show. I got my carbs back up to about 310 on training days and about 220 on off. I still felt miserable. And normally if I do that in the off season, I'd feel great, but I felt absolutely still horrible. No energy, just wanted to lay on the couch and be left alone. So, you know, even if you're able to reverse in and eat more food, you just get hungrier and you still just feel like shit if you're properly peeled and ready.
So. We haven't talked very much on this podcast about water, about liquids. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Leading up to a contest and general health wise, how much water should we be getting in? Protein shakes? Are you an advocate or not? Tell us a little bit about what you're drinking.
Okay. So water, I just tell my clients I'd like a gallon to a gallon and a half pure water daily. As it goes into a contest, I keep the water high. The only time I pull back is maybe on Friday, and that's going to depend on natural or if there's PEDs in and just how the athlete may be holding. But I like to keep water in all the way through, a gallon and a half to a gallon. Some bigger guys maybe at 2. But, you know, these people who are cranking 3, they're just diluting their electrolytes. And I don't believe their kidneys are getting any better, response for having to process 3 gallons of water. So I'm around there with it. And I'm sorry, what was your second question? It was water.
Protein shakes. Protein shakes. Yep. Are you an advocate of them?
Yes. So here's when I like protein shakes. I prefer it's whole food, but I like a good whey ISO post-workout with a carbohydrate, even in prep. I think there is benefit to getting the faster acting proteins in the system faster. Now, as far as the final week, if it's stevia based and it's a good product, I'm okay with keeping it in till Thursday or Friday. But generally, since I can't police every product, I just tell people to pull their shakes when they pull their artificial sweeteners, which is usually around Tuesday of the final week. Now I will make a shameless plug. I have a New Ethics has an ISO Perfect. It's only 5 ingredients for the chocolate, 4 for the vanilla, and it's stevia based. I'll use that all the way in. And when I travel to San Diego, if I have to eat 5 shakes with, you know, almond butter, I'll do it, and it's not going to bloat me at all. It's really pure. So if you can find a really pure whey ISO made with stevia, sure, rock it as much as you need. But in general, I only like 1 shake post-workout during the prep.
So Jason, we're at our hour here. For our listeners, how can they get in contact with you if they want to learn more about your coaching services And then also your supplement line, how can they learn more about the supplements you
manufacture? Sure. So I got a few ways to be contacted. I think everyone does these days. So on Instagram, I'm @ScoobyPrep_IFBBPro. Check it out. Like I post a lot of like before and afters. I post a lot of my clients. I've got a lot of my junior Nats clients who are getting ready to compete this week, and I'll be in Chicago with that, going for their pro cards. I post a lot of that, and I'll post some tidbits of like cool information and things like that. You can also hit me up on Facebook. It's just my name there. It's Jason and then Theobald, Theobald. You can email me at Jason@ScoobyPrep, and it's like it sounds, Scooby and then prep.com. And then as far as New Ethics, we have a website, newethics.com, newethix.com. And, we have about, 6 to 7 products right now. And a lot of our formulas are based on what I found during coaching and what my partner has found during coaching. So a lot of it isn't just meathead formulas of pump this, pump that. You know, we have stuff like Estracort that brings down estrogen. If you got estrogen dominance, we have Cordis that helps with cortisol. We've got a lot of different products that help with the health aspect, which is most important when you're losing fat. You can't, if you don't have a good, healthy foundation, you can't build the house. So that's really where we're at with our line. We didn't just want the same old bullshit. So that's where you can contact me, and that's where you can find out more about New Ethics. New Ethics is also on Instagram. Go ahead and follow it there as well.
One more question, Jason. So for New Ethics, are you shipping worldwide or are you U.S. domestic?
We're only U.S. domestic right now, but we hope to get into that point as we continue to grow, and we are growing.
Okay. Look into Canada. Like I'm over in Canada, and we have a really good bodybuilding scene here in Canada.
Okay. I will look into it and then see what our hurdles are into getting over there. Hopefully it's not too bad. I know like Australia is a nightmare in certain places, but hopefully they're not too strict. How's Canada on like supplements? Are they real strict or are they kind of looser like America or?
It's pretty, Canada's pretty easy, man. We actually have much less strict laws than the US when it comes to things like research chemicals, peptides, steroids.
Okay,
like
that. Could be a problem then.
Yeah, okay. like you know how you guys have the SARMs bill that's about to pass?
Yeah.
That's not even, they're not even talking about that here in Canada.
Gotcha. Yeah, because like I know a guy contacted me about Australia and like some of our formulas, like our thyroid boost and stuff, like because we have glandulars and different things, like we'd have to reformulate. And I'm like, no, the products are what we need as they are. So yeah, that sounds like it's the next step for us to look into.
Generally speaking, if a product's FDA compliant, it's legal in Canada as well.
Okay. Then we're good. Got it. Okay.
For our listeners, I'll have all those links in the show description. So you can just click those. You don't have to worry about trying to write them down or anything like that. For your host, Trevor Kuritzen, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for our special guest, IFBB Pro, Jason Theobald, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.